Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today's interview is going to be with Patrick Cohen. At Film Invasion LA in 2018, Patrick's film First Dates was one of the crowd pleasers. Extremely well acted, a great well-written story, and one of those things that's kind of rare in a short film these days, which is, it's kind of a feel-good movie. And there's nothing wrong with feeling bad, but it's always nice for an audience to get to feel good, right? First Dates has not been released online yet, although I think that's coming pretty soon. But I had Patrick come in anyway. We did a great interview, and then we did a four questions, which is going to be the podcast after this. So I'm not going to say go to discoverindiefilm.com to see First Dates, although you can go to discoverindiefilm.com to see a bunch of great films, a lot of shorts, a lot of links to features, and all kinds of other things. But no need for any more setup. Let's talk to Patrick Cohen.
I loved movies my whole life. Grew up watching movies, couldn't get enough movies. I've always liked sports, but I didn't really watch sports because if I was on my own, I'd rather watch a movie. And then I got to college and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I, for the first time, wasn't playing sports because I went to a D1 school. So I just had a lot of free time. And a buddy of mine who was the theater department was like, hey, you should come out for a play. Audition for this Shakespeare play with me.
And we were at the college level?
Yeah, college. So it was junior year in college before I did the first acting ever. I did like stupid middle school plays, but like, you know, that everybody had to be a part of. But before that,
you were just a film buff.
I wouldn't even say buff. I just said I like movies.
Right.
You know, I just liked movies. I wouldn't necessarily know directors' names, and I wouldn't know, you know, the details. I would just be like, I like Indiana Jones. I could watch the Star Wars trilogy three times in a row. Like I could watch all the I'd do a Rocky marathon. You know, I just loved movies. And I ended up becoming an English major because I didn't know it at the time, but when I read books, I would see a movie in my head. You know, I was a very visual person, but I didn't even like necessarily know that. So then junior year in college, I finally auditioned for a play. I had one line, and I remember like it was a Love's Labor's Lost, a Shakespeare play. Right. And, the first day of the table read, I sat down and I looked around and everybody's kind of reading out of the book. Nobody knew anything about this play really. And I'm like, in 4 weeks, this is going to be on stage. Everybody's going to be off book. I'm going to be an audience. And I was like, that's cool. And I kind of, you know, they talk about the bug. I guess I kind of get the bug. I was like, this is awesome. So I did every play. I basically ended up minoring in theater and pretty much knew when I graduated, I was like, ah, shit, I think I want to do this.
And you were in what part of the country?
I grew up in Connecticut. I went to school in Providence College, so in Providence, Rhode Island. So I moved back home, like everybody does these days, because everything's too expensive. Stayed at home, worked a little bit to save some money to move to New York. So I went after college, I moved to New York to pursue theater. Yeah,
right. And solely acting.
Yeah. I just wanted to be an actor. I mean, I wanted to. I didn't grow up knowing anybody. It's funny when I teach kids now and like they grew up in LA, you know, when I teach like a young actor and they grew up in LA, like they perceive acting as a potential career. I didn't ever think of that as a viable option. So even when I knew I wanted to do it, I moved to New York basically like, I have no idea if this is something. A, I don't know if I'm good at this. B, I don't know if this is what I think it is. You know, it's to have fun in a school play might not be, and it's not, spoiler alert, the life of a working actor, you know?
Yeah, but also it shows you had more guts than most because that was a much more blind leap over the acting cliff than, like you say, someone who grew up in a world where there's working actors around.
I think it was brave. I also think it was naive and in a good way because I didn't know any better. It's easy to be brave when you don't think of it as being brave. You know what I mean? A lot of times when you're an actor like in middle school and then you go and you're like doing it all through high school and you're taking it really seriously and you're studying and then you go to try to get your MFA. By the time you're actually feet on the street, you're like probably a little burnt, if not burnt out, at least you're like been through the ringer a little bit.
And you've had adults your whole life telling you when you get to a certain age, you're going to want to pursue agents, you want to do this, audition.
Yeah, and instead I was like, dude, I've been in like four plays total. I know for a fact I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm going to find a class, I'm going to work my ass off, and I'm going to see if I like being on stage professionally. And the other thing is, of course, it's the same reason they send 18-year-olds to war, right? Like, when you're that young, you're like, I'll be fine. I'll figure it out. So, you know, 22-year-old Patrick was like, I mean, I might not be a movie star next week, but I'll be fine, you know?
Well, and at 22, you're the the apartment you're willing to live in and and all that. It's just, you're like, three to a room, I don't care.
Well,
I'm in New York.
I mean, the thing about New York that's good and bad is that no matter who you are, you're in a tiny apartment. It's just a question of whether it's on the Upper West Side or if it's way.
So where were you?
So I was actually, most of my friends were in Queens, but I actually was in Manhattan. I was at 207th and Broadway, which is the last stop in the A train, which is so far north that people are like, there's a 207 and it's still in Manhattan.
Yeah, it's
everybody
the Bronx,
was like, oh,
right?
Everybody was like, oh, you're in the Bronx. I was like, no, I'm in Manhattan. I'm the last stop before the Bronx. But it was actually a great neighborhood because it was kind of away. It was a little, I mean, away from it all. It's a 20-minute subway ride, but it feels like it's away from it all. I was right next to a park, and it was this beautiful little Dominican neighborhood, and it was just really cool. So I lived there. I hate moving, so I found a place I liked and I stayed there for, I don't know, I was in New York for 7 years, I guess, and I was in that same apartment the whole time.
So pretty much your whole 20s, it was
my 20s was acting in New York. Yeah, I worked as a personal trainer in a gym on the Upper West Side and did every opportunity that could possibly come my way. I went after, and you know, I mean, it was kind of my grad school was those first 4 years of doing horrible off Broadway theater that you'd go into tech and be like, oh crap, I don't want to invite any friends to this show. This show is terrible. You know, I did a lot of those, but that's kind of where I learned.
And by the way, congratulations, because that's one of my complaints with actors. When people come to LA to act, and they're like, well, I don't want to do plays, I don't want to do stuff in small theaters.
Right.
I'm like, where do you think you're going to start?
Well, it's such a New York mentality that like, there's almost like a, and I shouldn't wax poetic because I don't know, maybe it's 20s versus 30s, right? But I felt like it was New York versus LA, where it was like there's this honor among thieves idea that we're gonna bust our ass, and it's cool if there's four people in the audience, and it's cool if the place sucks, and it's cool if we're not getting paid. We're doing a showcase contract, whatever, to pay for our subway token. That's fine, man. And I think, I could be wrong, I think LA attracts more of the I need to be a movie star mentality than I need to be an actor.
It does.
So I think there's less of there's less patience.
It does. And honestly, gigs, just the words, I'm in something that's off Broadway, sounds a whole lot better than I'm in something in Glendale.
Yeah.
I mean, ego wise.
Right. Totally.
But I think you're totally right.
Yeah.
People come here less in love with the craft and more seeking fame.
I think so, and which is understandable, right? I mean, LA just, I think, and some of it, I mean, for me, honestly, well, it was totally geographic. It was like, New York is an hour and a half away from where I grew up. My first few months of auditioning, I was taking the train from my parents' house in Guilford, Connecticut, you know what I mean? So it was way safer and easier to be like, I'm going to go to New York. I actually didn't really think about LA at first, because again, I was trying to dip my toe in and kind of see if this is something I wanted to do. So like a cross-country move would have been.
And by the way, so you dipped your toe. So did you completely fall in love during those first couple years?
Yeah. I think you have to kind of understand, I think, as an actor, I think as any part of the film or theater industry, right? But I think as an actor, you have to kind of realize that when you're outside and you're getting ready to get into it, if you think it's gonna be tough for all that rejection, it's gonna be tough to audition and not get the part, that's the easy part, dude. The hard part is like, I'm not getting any auditions. I have an agent, they can't get me in the room, and I'm reading the breakdowns, and there's three roles that I'm great for, and they're not even big roles. I want this co-star and I can't get in, you know, because you don't realize they get 2,000 submissions for this one line role on this show, you know what I mean? So I think the actual hard part is the lack of opportunity to be rejected is harder than, because when you get rejected, it's like you kind of won the lottery in order to get into the room. And then if you didn't get the job, it's okay.
Yeah, at least you're auditioning.
But yeah, knowing that they saw 20 people total for this job, it's cool to get in there. And that's the biggest kind of awakening, I think, for somebody new to the industry is like, dude, it's just hard to. It's hard to play the game. Forget winning the game. It's hard to play the game. It's like a board game where you're trying to win, but you have to. There's only four seats.
Yeah.
It's a poker game, and you're in the back of a very crowded room trying to just get a hand. You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you got rid of that. I got through that phase in your early 20s.
I got through that. So in the early 20s, I discovered that you never really know, like, am I good at this? But I realized this is something that I'm getting better at, and I'm really enjoying the process of. And, you know, enough modest success to be like, hey, this is not a complete waste of my time. I'm never going to buy a house with this money, but I have enough positive reinforcement from people who it's nice when somebody who you respect, who has made a career for themselves, turns to you and says, "You're good, man." You know, when you hear, you only need one or two of those.
Right, like you're in a play and yeah, you're a more accomplished actor.
Yeah, I was in a play with a guy named Kevin Tai, who, if you ever see the movie, my go-to for him is always Roadhouse. He's the guy that hires Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse, for any Roadhouse fans out there. But he was just a, you know, journeyman character actor. He was on he was a series reg on a show called Emergency in the 70s. And he probably won't even remember me if I ever saw him again. But we were all getting drinks after a show, and he was like, "You're good at this. Just keep going." He's like, "When I was your age, there were 400 of me in the waiting room. Now there's 3 of me in the waiting room," because, you know, he was an older guy. And I was like, you know, to hear from somebody whose IMDb page is that long, who's been doing this forever, it's like, that's cool. So that kind of, you only need a couple of those here and there. And if you have a passion for this, to keep the flame burning. And then, you know, you reach those points, obviously, where it's like, you kind of reexamine every few years, every 5 years, maybe, of like, do I want to do this? Do I want to still to keep doing this? And ultimately I just enjoy it so much that it's like, until I get to the point where I'm like, I mean, I was telling, my father a while back, like, I'll have an audition, and when it goes really well, you know, obviously it's just my perception, when it goes really well according to me, I'll leave the audition and be like, I'm good. Like, it's like, I'm like a drug addict. If like your high lasts for 2 or 3 weeks, I'm like, I'm good for 2 or 3 weeks. And if that feeling goes away, if I leave an audition and I'm like, ugh, I don't want to do this anymore, like, that'll be a wake up call for me. But at the moment, like, it's just great. It's fun, you know? So I was in New York doing all that, and then hooked up with these guys who were making a web series. And this was in like 2007, so I'd never heard of a web series. I was like, "What's a web series?" And it's like a TV show online. I don't understand. So they were making a show called We Need Girlfriends, which was kind of the first web series to hit it. I don't remember Quarter Life. We were like the same time as Quarter Life. It was like a Quarter Life Crisis show. We were like the same time as them, and like them, we actually got picked up to be produced as a television pilot. We were way before kind of anybody was watching.
I remember Quarter Life. I remember the title Quarter Life.
Yeah, Quarter Life. Yeah, we were like that same year, and Darren Star, who created Sex and the City, kind of saw our show, and I wasn't, you know, I was the actor hired. I wasn't involved in the creative process, but I was friends with those guys, so I got to kind of be around for that process where they wanted to make a television show, and I was like, that's cool. And just walking around New York, I was being recognized from the show, and I was like, okay, this is cool. And that kind of lit a fire under me to get out to LA. Cause I was like, I'd done theater, you know, horrible, sometimes mediocre, every now and then good theater in New York for, I don't know, at the time, 7 years or something. And it was like one little tiny, not even TV show that I did. And all of a sudden it's like immediately I had so much more feedback from people and so much, I mean, such a chance for people to watch. Like, my parents could watch it. My family that never seen me act could watch it. It was just really cool. I remember I was on a date with a girl, and we were on the subway, and this gorgeous, like, 25-year-old girl comes running up to me and goes, "Oh, my God, you're from We Need Girlfriends. Can I have a photo?" And, like, talk about a good first date. Like, I was like gold. I was like, man, this is cool. So I liked that, and I was like, all right, well, I guess I want to focus on TV and film now. This is fun.
From it being on the web?
It was on the web. Yeah, it was on...
Right. So the Darren Star thing didn't...
So we got to, you know, a few 100,000 views each episode, and we just did one season, and pretty much right around the time we were shooting the final episode is when that deal was going through. And so we held off on doing season 2 while they were selling the show, and then, you know, as things often are.
And it almost happened.
I wouldn't even say almost. I would say we were almost told it would happen. Like, you know, you're told it would happen, and it almost happened. But it was enough. So the creators of that show moved out here, and I came out with them, and I was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go to L.A. and
right, because it was clear to you that there was more potential in L.A.
At the time, of course, story of my life, I ran track. I leave high school and they build a brand new track. And I'm an actor in New York who wants to do TV and film. There's like no TV. There's like Law and Order and that's it. I leave New York and tons of TV goes to New York. But at the time, there wasn't a lot there. So I thought there were more opportunities.
There's still a lot less there.
But a lot of it's more local hire. Like L.A., the dirty secret is, like, you know, most shows that cast in L.A. don't shoot in L.A. anymore. Yeah. So, you know, but coming out to L.A. for opportunity, but also it had become clear to me that everybody I knew that was kind of really doing well in New York either went to Juilliard or one of these, you know, I'd done shows with MFAs who sucked. So I was like, I don't need to spend 4 years of my life or three, to go through that program in order to be right where I am now. But, you know, that on your resume helps. But really everybody I knew that was doing well was doing musical theater. And, you know, I can carry a tune, but I'm not getting in front of thousands of people and singing. That's not
in New York. Yeah, in New York, the highest success really is Broadway.
Yeah, if you're doing a straight play, you're doing it for the love of the craft. And I was like, you know, I mean, it'd be nice to pursue avenues that might pay a little bit more. And you know, I was ready for, and also at the time I was nearing the end of my 20s, and I was like, I wouldn't mind some space. I wouldn't mind. You'd be able to, you know, breathe a little bit in my home. Like my, you know, your apartment in New York's like a closet. It's like where you go when you're ready to pass out and fall asleep. It's like not where you
live. I know the people that are like a married couple with a kid in a studio where a closet is the baby's room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, as a trainer, I would work with some very rich people. Right. And I went to some beautiful apartments on the Upper West Side or on Park Avenue or whatever. And like, even those apartments, dude, they're like, they're gorgeous and they're doorman building and it's barely enough room to breathe in the apartment. You know, everything's tiny. So, I came out here on a trip with some other actors and kind of explored it. And I was like, man, for comparable pricing, I could have twice as much space and like,
yeah, more space and great weather.
Yeah. And the industry. So it was kind of time, you know, I think New York's kind of like college. It's like you drink four nights a week. You have a kind of it's an automatic social life. You're on the subway. You bump into somebody. They're like, hey, you want to come out tonight? And you know it's fun and but you need energy for that. You need to. I think it's a good young. It's good if you're really rich and it's good if you're young. And I think I was definitely not the former, and I was approaching the end of the ladder. And I was like, it's time for a change. So, knowing what I know now, could have gone to Atlanta or some other avenue, but I'm glad I came here because
the Atlanta shift came
much later. Yeah. But you know, I mean,
people would have told you to go to Vancouver at one point.
Well, yeah, I think
that was a little earlier. I think,
I think no matter what there's two ways to do it, right? You can be like, I'm going to go where the low hanging fruit is, which is great, especially for somebody who has no TV credits, I think is a really good move. But ultimately, like, you know, if you want to be the highest level, you go to the Olympics, right? You know, so this is the Olympics. So it's a cool town to be
in. So what was it like when you got here?
It was actually good. I hit the ground running a little bit. I for whatever reason,
we had the momentum of that web series.
The web series was it made me, I think, an easy pitch at the time. No one cares now, but at the time it was a little bit of heat. And then I think I hooked up with a manager and an agent pretty much right away. And yeah, I mean, I think the first year was getting learning the city and figuring out the day job stuff and all that, and then I started working, and I mean, most of my TV credits probably come from those first 3 years in LA. Like, I hit the ground running pretty good, and then, you know, as is always the case, things slow down, you have to kind of redirect, and it's actually good that they did. Obviously, I'd rather be a series regular right now than not, but because things slowed down, I was like, well, I have to start writing, I have to start making my own stuff. I don't want to be one of those actors that waits for the phone to ring and complains about how hard this town is. Because, you know, I moved here after busting my ass in New York and expecting to have to work twice as hard here. So I came here expecting to go to war. And my least favorite thing is when you talk to an actor who kind of expects it to be handed to them. It's like, dude, why are you complaining about how hard it is? Every single person you've ever met said, you're an actor? That's crazy. That's so hard. Why would you do that? You know, some version of that conversation happens with everybody's parents, with everybody's friends. It's like, you know, you got to know you're going to war, and why are you surprised when they're shooting at you? You know, it's like, of course it's hard, you know? I don't know. I think it's been up and down, but I think it's always up and down.
But so you started and writing, you started
so
writing.
I started writing. I started trying to,
with an eye to like direct and make,
honestly, I started with it just to keep, some artistic sanity. Cause I read an interesting, I forget where it was, some article about artists and talking about how, and my mother was a musician, and you could practice your violin every day, right? An artist can paint every day. And for some reason, that makes no sense to me. Actors wait for somebody to give them the opportunity to practice every day. You know, an actor should grab a camera and a friend every day and shoot something and work on something.
Or get in a class.
Right. I mean, yeah. And you got to work on your craft pretty much every day, I think, in general. But sometimes you can be a little bit like, well, this is great. I'm doing all the scene study. I'm doing all this work. I'm not having any. Again, if you feel yourself not auditioning, not getting auditioned, that can be kind of a frustrating process. And it's really great to divert some of that energy and be like, I'm going to write a short. I'm going to write a feature. I'm going to write a pilot. I'm going to write a spec of some show. I'm going to submit to the fellowships. And that, what that does for somebody who's new to writing, who doesn't necessarily expect immediate success from it, is it just gives you a chance to have a voice and not wait for somebody to tell you that you can come in for this 3-line co-star. You can be an artist. And what's great about writing, I have found, is it feeds the acting. You know, it helps, it makes it easier for you to understand what and break down a scene, just in, mm-hmm. in simplest terms, I think. But it also, it kind of reignites why you like this stuff.
Right.
You know?
And it sounds like you're saying, in a way, it adds depth to your acting, or
totally.
Makes you a better actor.
I mean, obviously everybody's different, right?
Yeah.
But in my experience, it fuels.
Yeah. Of course, Daniel Day-Lewis may have never written anything, and he's fine.
Right. Right. But I mean, Robert De Niro used to fill journals with his character's voice and thoughts. You know, like, so.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was like, that's a bit overkill, Bobby. You know, but like, clearly there's something to be said for that, and I just found it a really helpful way to kind of stay an artist in what can be a very unartistic town. Sometimes it's very hard to feel like an artist. If you're a journeyman actor who's busting his ass to try to get a job, and when you do get a job, you go out for a commercial where you talk about how you're, thank God this medication cured my hemorrhoids. It's like hard to feel like an artist, right? So it's nice to be able to, at any point, grab your laptop and be like, I'm gonna make some art right now. And so I started writing really just with the idea that I want to see, similar to acting, I want to put my toe in this and see if it's something that fuels me and feeds me. And I was fortunate enough to hook up with a friend of mine, Alexa Alemani, who teaches kind of a writing for actors class. And then I went on, and she does a writing lab. So I meet with these people weekly, and it's been great, because what I find is, similar to acting, I was like, okay, I have no idea how to do this. I don't know if I'd be good at this. I was an English major, so I knew how to, I knew how to write. I'd taken creative writing class before, but it's different when you're trying to figure out if you want to write a script or something and how.
You've been reading scripts for over a decade, right?
Reading scripts, so. Yeah, and God, watching movies, like, it's my job.
I mean,
so
some,
like,
people decide to write, and they're like, okay, what's the format?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you knew
yeah.
all that.
I knew that, and I had kind of an inherent understanding of 3-act structure just from watching thousands of things, but it's nice to have somebody who knows how to do this to kind of break it down for you, and how do you write 1-hour TV? What's the difference between writing a network show or a cable show, like, in terms of format, in terms of act breaks and all that stuff? It's kind of helpful to get that going. So I kind of originally started just as, I want to find my voice as a writer in order to feel like an artist. And then it turned into, I actually think I'd like to pursue this a bit more and break into television writing, which is like the really hard to do when you're a 40-year-old white guy who has no television experience. But it's really, I think it's something I'd be good at. So I've been submitting to the festivals and writing a lot more pilots and specs and trying to get more into that. And I'm chasing representation right now, so I'm just kind of getting going with that.
Right, literary.
Literary representation. Yeah. It's just been a really good exercise. And that, I also got into, you know, directing a little bit, which is something I thought I'd be good at. And that kind of all coincided with my acting teacher, Annie Grinley, asking me if I'd be interested in teaching, which is, again, it's just the same idea where teaching fuels writing, fuels acting, fuels directing, and they're all interrelated, right? It's, I used to say TV and theater were like sculpture and painting, but really I think acting is like painting, and like directing is like sculpture, and like writing is maybe, you know, charcoal. You know, there's all different versions of art that you don't have to be a master of all of them to get something out of any of them, I think. So I used to always think, like, I just want to be an actor. I don't want to worry about the rest of it. But it's the only thing I know for sure is producing's not for me.
Oh.
The logistical stuff is just not my bag.
It is tough.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, so you started writing before you started teaching acting?
Yeah. Yeah. Which I'm glad I did, because I actually think in those writing labs and in hearing people much smarter and more successful than me break down scripts and stuff, it gave me more insight that I can share because obviously the first thing with a teacher is the imposter syndrome, right? There's like the whole those who can't teach kind of idea. So I'd get into,
yeah. I mean, I wish that trope would go away.
Well, I think those are bad teachers, right?
Yeah.
But I think. I think something about teaching actors and knowing some of the writing and directing side of it makes me feel like I have more valuable insight and kind of help me get over that initial. Because, you know, if I'm coaching on a series regular job and I've never had a series regular job, it's easy to feel unworthy of the job, you know, which is not true. I mean, listen, I was a strength and conditioning coach for semi-pro athletes in New York. It's like, dude, those guys lifted more weights than me and ran faster than I'll ever run in my life, but I could still train them. I just, you know, I can understand something even though I can't, might not be doing it currently. So, but it takes a little, you have to wrap your head around kind of.
Yeah. But that, also passion, you know, for the craft. I know of a lot of successful actors, you know, character actors, people you see all the time.
Yeah.
People I've known a long time who've been a lot of film and TV, and they teach acting because they also just have something to give back.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I wish it wasn't like those who can't do teach, because that's,
yeah, I mean, that's,
I hate that thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think there's certainly, I think it's very similar to directing, where I think a really good director, and I've worked with some, and I've worked with some that aren't good. Right. And I think usually what separates them is a director has to have a vision. But if they're a great director or even a good director, I think they understand it's a collaborative process. So they come at it, they're gonna tell you kind of what they're looking for and try to get out of you what they want. But they're also gonna be open to, like, what are you bringing to it? What's your version of this? Because hopefully, if I'm your director, I hired you because I saw your version of this, right? Not the one in my head. Because if you have a version in your head, chances are you're not a very collaborative person, so chances are you're probably not going to make a very good filmmaker.
You know, that's actually one of the reasons why I really like your film First Dates, is that in all the films I see, you can tell the films that are made by a director who cares about the technical side of filmmaking and ignores performance. And of course, there's no way with the way you came up through it that you would be a director who ignores performance. And just listening to you now, I was thinking, yeah, I mean, so many people are focused on, like, the David Fincher side of directing.
Yeah,
of, like, totally. I just want to be visually stunning.
Totally.
And it's like, the director's first job is that performance.
Yeah.
And bringing out the best performance is not telling them how to perform. But, yeah, aiding them. I once saw Steven Soderbergh at a Q&A say that, like, my job is to create a velvet-lined shoot that just lets the actor jump in and just slide right to their best performance, like, effortlessly.
That's great.
Like he sees himself as in service to the actor.
Yeah. Thank you for the compliment, by the way. I think part of that is necessity. I didn't go to film school. I'm not, you know, I paired myself with...
You're not going to start shouting out lens.
No, I paired myself with Chris Kramer, who is a great DP, who basically helped my film look competently visual, because that's not yet. I would love to grow in that way. So I mean, I would naturally lean into my strengths, which would be working with the actors, right? But yeah, there's a lot of really good stuff out there. As you know, I mean, the film Invasion was great. It was a great festival. That was my favorite festival that I did last year.
Thanks.
You found some really good films, and I think
those were good. That was a good lineup.
But excluding, there's a lot of really good films out there. So I'm not trying in any way to be disparaging, but oftentimes you'll go to a festival or you'll see a bunch of sometimes features, but usually shorts, right? And I'm amazed that almost always the weakest link, I mean, sound, a lot of times sound's terrible, but the weakest link is often performance.
Yeah.
Which blows my mind, because I know so many actors that are amazing, that are out of work, right?
And every time you see one of those, sometimes they're student film maybe, or it is someone who wants to direct, they want to make a film, and I don't know if they use friends or if they just do one of those, you know, backstage casting calls.
But even, I mean, I've done casting calls, right? And, like, even if you have no experience and you don't know any actors, which, if you're in L.A., grab a friend who knows actors. Like, it's not that, right? But if you're not in L.A., I understand, you know. But even if you know nothing about this, like, there are good actors. If you hold an audition, you'll find some. And if you don't...
Maybe they're giving good actors a shitty script.
It's
and
possible.
They're giving them
a
bad situation, the opposite of Soderbergh's velvet line slide. Maybe those actors are in an awful position.
Maybe.
But I think more likely it's lack of experience.
It could be lack of experience. Also, I know, I mean, I'm a fledgling filmmaker, so I'm not trying to speak out of turn here. But I know also, like, that on the day it's tough, right? Like, you've raised money from probably everybody you've ever met in your life to give you $15 on Indiegogo, and you're all excited, and you get your camera, and you're out there, and you're like, we're losing the light, or the location's not working, or we pissed off the neighbors, and they're like calling, you know, like, there's
that's
so much.
That's because it wasn't planned.
Right. Cool. Well, sure, of course. But there's so much to deal with that I do think there's a bit of, hurry up and go. We got to shoot. We got to move on. Instead of
and performance is sacrificed.
Performance
that's
sacrificed.
The first thing sacrificed.
And I would think like if anything has to be sacrificed, it would not be performed. I would think like okay, we have three setups planned. Let's do two.
And just rehearsal, kill the performance. Right?
Well, yeah, that could be part of it too.
Rehearsals often sacrificed because people, I don't know what they expect.
Well, so I know. I mean, in this town, scheduling is a nightmare, right? So I know it's tough. I mean, I know if I'm doing a project and they're like, we're going to have rehearsals, my first, I roll my eyes. I'm like, ugh. The rehearsal's a great concept, but it's hard to put into practice because almost nobody's going to have enough money for paid rehearsals.
Right.
So you're out of pocket to rehearse something that if you're the caliber actor that we should have hired, probably doesn't need the rehearsal. I mean, when I made my shoot, I was fortunate enough to work with Anisha, who is awesome, but also very nice and accommodating and just the most pleasant person you'll ever meet. And I was like, hey, can we run this a couple times before the day? And she was like, of course. So she came over, you know,
Go ahead, tell me this. So, you were writing, I assume you wrote a bunch of shorts and some.
Yeah.
And, what made you choose First Dates or?
So it's funny.
Or is it not even the first one
It's not the first one. It's the first one I shot. It's not the first one I wrote. But and I mean, I shot some scenes and some, you know, some. My new thing is I'm going to write some stuff and shoot reels for actors just to practice directing, and also because it's easier to write a scene that you like than to figure out this is a full story, you know. So I'm probably going to go that way a little bit, you know, just really on the cheap. But this was the first kind of full short I made, and yeah, I wrote. So I wrote one that I really liked that I'm going to make this year that was, it's almost like a little mini episode of Black Mirror. And it's kind of, for whatever reason, it's funny. One of the things you learn when you write a lot is kind of what you gravitate towards, with, you know, thematically. And I mean, movie taste, I'm all over the map. So it was hard for me as a viewer to be like, what do I like? And then, as an actor, like most jackasses, I'm like, I want to do everything. Just hire me. So it's hard. I mean, I like comedy, but I'm happy to, you know, it's hard to even say what I gravitate to. But when you write, you find yourself, whether you mean to or not, writing about stuff that you care about, stuff, themes that you're interested in. And for whatever reason, could be the political climate, but I think it probably even before that, truth was always kind of a big theme for me and the manipulation of it. So, and even First Dates, which is, I think, a really sweet, simple story, there's a little manipulation of the truth. In this case, it's the audience that doesn't.
Yeah, you're playing. You're not intentionally playing one over on the audience.
Right. They're both in the know.
Yeah.
Both characters are in the know, and they're kind of playing a game. But then the reveal is it's not the truth. Yeah. The audience.
But you did that obviously when you wrote it. You knew.
Right.
That you had a reveal.
Right. But again, most of my reveals tend to involve truth. So you see this theme again, which I just think is really interesting. But so I wrote one that's kind of all about how hard it is to connect with people in today's day and age, based, you know, social media and the internet and all that, and how hard it is to actually have a moment of connection with a real human being. So I wrote this kind of sci-fi-ish short film that, I mean, it's sci-fi-ish, definitely ish. It requires basically one or two visual effects and it's done. It's very, very doable. But I wrote that, and even that was like, not for the first film. Let's keep it simple, you know? And so I had this kind of smaller idea that was First Dates, and I thought, well, let me shoot First Dates, because what's great about this is that it's actually the same basic setup as the harder-to-make movie, which is two people in a restaurant. And I was terrified of, I mean, you know, I don't know if maybe non-filmmakers don't appreciate this, but two people talking for an entire short at a table. I was like, can I do that? Is that going to be the most visually boring short of all time? And the answer probably is yes, but I think, you know,
doesn't have to be.
You get away with it when Anisha smiles at the camera, but like, you know, I was a little worried that, so I thought, let me kind of, and I also intentionally wore too many hats. I was like, let me get some growing pains here. Like, you know, let me produce this and write this and direct this and act in it. All the things that anybody would tell you, don't do all that. What are you, nuts? But I was like, I want to kind of see, similar to what I did with acting and writing in the first place, is I want to kind of dip my toe in and see where I gravitate. And like I said, definitely not producing. But I love directing. I don't know that I would want to direct myself again. I'm fortunate enough that I've seen enough of my work that I think I can be objective about it. But it's hard to be objective about it and try to craft the whole thing at the same. You know, it's kind of a lot to do.
So, would you have preferred another actor playing your role, or would you have preferred to have someone direct you?
I'm egomaniacal, so there's no way to answer that. Because how could an actor ever want somebody else to have that role? But also, when you write this thing and you see it a certain way, you know, I definitely that actually is the biggest question right now, moving into my next and bigger project and probably everything after that, is at what point do I want to put the acting forward, and at what point do I want to make sure I make the best? Because I really, at the end of the day, if I'm going to make the best movie I can make, I have to kind of focus on filmmaking, right? I think I can write a really good script and be in it, and I think I can direct somebody else's script and not be in it or be in it, but I just think all three is tough, right?
Of course it's tough.
So I have a feeling I'm going to do it one more time.
You should.
I think I'm going to do it one more time.
You know, shorts, there's almost no reason not to keep stretching yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as I told you at the Q&A, one of the things that impressed me about your film is that you clearly highlighted the other performer. We're in a short with two people talking at a table. There's really not a lead in supporting. But you definitely make her the lead.
Yeah, she's definitely... I mean, even when I wrote it, even before I had... I guess I shouldn't say it because you can't write and not have a visual idea. But before I even put on the filmmaking hat, when I was just writing
if you were a good screenwriter, it's visual.
Sure, of course. Yeah, well, yeah. But even when I was first writing it, it was always her story. You know, I mean, we open with her. He comes in.
Because women dominate us when it comes to dating.
Well, I'm just kidding. I actually, it's funny. It's not like the Me Too movement per se, but I am fascinated by how few stories are actually revolving around a woman being the center of it that isn't about her sexuality or her looks or her, you know, I mean, Anisha's a beautiful woman, but it's got nothing to do with the story. You know what I mean? The idea that, I don't know. I found myself writing way more female leads than I ever thought I would have. And as a brand new writer, of course, you think, I don't know if I can write women, you know, like I'm a guy, you know. And then you get into it and you're like, well, no, I'm going to write a story about somebody. And oftentimes I will be, this happened to me in a feature I wrote. I was about halfway through the process and I was like, it'd just be more interesting if it was her story.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than how many movies are his story. It's happened so many times. It just makes you feel sometimes like I'm retreading. I mean, everything's a retread. There's only like three stories, right? But I'm retreading too much if it's another.
I'm with you 100%.
Story, you know? It's one of those things that, you know, when done poorly is going to feel like it's political. And when done well, it's going to feel like a story that we haven't heard yet.
Exactly.
Because we haven't really heard those stories yet. You know, think about like a really powerful female movie that doesn't involve rape or you know, or daddy, you know, like it's so many of the...
Yeah, I'm showing my lack of sophistication. I can't name the test. What's the name of the test?
The Rorschach test, where you look at something and you...
No, a woman came up with a test where a film passes the test if there's at least one scene with two women where they speak to each other and they're not talking about a man.
And it's disgusting how small that list is.
I know a woman who's a strong feminist actress and producer and writer, and she laughed at, she brings that test up all the time, and she goes, oh my God, I'm 0 for 3. Like, my three films, I don't have female characters doing that.
Right. Well, so we did an exercise in Writing Lab that was great. And so it's one of those subtle, don't even realize you have a problems, right? And it was, in your action, you can't describe any female character based on how she looks.
Yeah.
And like, if you read a script, man, it's like the guy is clever and charming and the girl is cute in that girl next way kind of, you know, the girl next door kind of way, or like hot but doesn't know it. You know, like all, like everything, even if you read the breakdowns, man, it's crazy.
It's objectification. You know?
Of course. Yeah, of course. And listen, it's TV. Or film. At the end of the day, almost nobody's going to be not attractive. We get it. They're good looking. They're all good looking people. Why do you have to put it down on paper that the woman is you know? Trust me, we're going to watch these people on a 40-foot screen up close. They're going to be good looking people. They're going to be. We don't have to talk about that in the script. You know.
True.
Yeah.
No, that's whatever. I'll probably cut this out. But one of the things I love, I do to people. So my stepdaughter's 11 at this point, and when people come, oh, she's so pretty now, and I just say, even to women my age, who's to have sons and daughters, I go, she has value beyond her appearance, and they all go, oh.
But isn't that such the default?
Because no one looks at a boy and goes, oh, he's so cute. They go, Tommy seems smart. Tommy's a good athlete. Tommy's this, and the women only get complimented. I'm like, don't compliment her.
Yeah,
just if she's getting cute, like. Doesn't really matter.
Right. No, it's such the default. It's such a default setting that it's one of those things that I think it's so hard to realize until you start pointing it out regularly. that it's, you know, it's a microaggression, right? But you don't think of it that way because you think of girls being pretty, you know?
It is.
Sugar and spice and everything nice, you know? Like, that's what you think, you know? Yeah.
Shit, when Kristen Sinema got sworn in as a senator, everyone, male and female, talked about how beautiful she was.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was a dick and I went on Facebook and I was like, two feminist friends, women, I was like, you know, more impressive than her looks is the fact that she has a master's and a PhD.
Think about Michelle Obama, man. Like, one of the most powerful, dynamic women in public office in my lifetime. And everybody talks about her arms. Her arms are so toned.
Princeton graduate.
Yeah. But she had Linda Hamilton arms.
Her husband, you know, every day of their marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. And all you talk about is her workout.
Yeah,
what's Michelle Obama's workout? What's her regimen? What's her diet? Yeah. That's all anybody's talking about. Dude, Obama was fit. Nobody was talking about what his workout was, other than he likes to play basketball.
Yeah. You know? I hear people are afraid to guard him, though.
I bet.
That's why he got so many open shots.
You pick him too hard, the Secret Service is all over you. Right, yeah. Exactly.
I think the Secret Service is who he's playing against. Oh, yeah. All right, so I derailed you.
Yeah.
Yes, we're good. Well, you know, it is funny. I mean, for me, as a white male, watching another white male's film, you know, I like, all right, cool. You know, he cast a non, you know, you.
Oh, and that was totally an accident. But
you cast the best female you could find.
I cast immediately the person I thought was right for the role. And it was a friend of mine that was like, oh, you it was a good idea because you're such a I'm like the whitest man anybody will ever meet, right? They're like, you're so white and you're such a man that it's good that you have hired diversity. And I was like, oh yeah, she is diverse. I didn't think of it that way. And I'm not trying to be douchey. Like, I don't see color. I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm saying so I did a web series called Three's a Crowd. Nigel Campbell wrote and directed and it came out great. I think that this web series, it's a like a gay love triangle, and she played the lead's best friend, and she was like one of the boys. She was like this really cool, and I knew what I wanted for my movie was this girl who you could believe was my best friend. And I mean, however much my movie works or doesn't work, I think it's important that you don't think he should just date her or he has a crush on her, or you shouldn't think too many of those thoughts in the first couple of minutes of my movie, or there's no journey to go on, right?
Yeah.
I think. So I wanted to make sure it was somebody that like I could believe it would be like shooting the shit with. And she has that quality. She has this kind of, you know, cool friend vibe that she brings.
I mean, she does that perfectly.
Yeah, yeah.
She does the transition perfectly where she goes from treating you like buddy to date.
Yeah, absolutely.
Her that transition is what sells me every time.
And I knew she could do it because she was in the show and she did such a good job playing like the shit talking friend, right? And then I met her in real life and she was like the nicest, sweetest, loveliest. And I was like, oh, you got both everything I want. You have right there. And I knew I wanted to do this as smoothly as possible. So that, you know, there's only two actors. One of them is me, and I wanted to use a DP that I knew, and I'd work and Chris at all. So I actually cherry picked a lot from Three's a Crowd because Chris was the DP on that show. I basically was like, this looks good, this sounds good, the actors are good. Let me just pull all this to my team because why not, right? So I wanted to kind of make it as
saves
smooth
you sitting
as
down and looking at reels, yeah.
Yeah, and not that I don't think that's a valuable process, but like, listen, when you have one day to shoot your first project, let's make sure it's people we know and we trust already. And you know, the one exception to that I probably was my sound guy who ended up not showing up on the day. Thank God Chris was like, I have some mics, and we mic'd it up, and I spent the whole day shoot being like, we're gonna have to ADR all of this is a waste, this is horrible. And then the sound sounded great. It actually came, and we used the farm for our post, and those guys are amazing. It all ended up great, but it's because, you know, I surrounded myself with people that were good at what they did.
You made good decisions.
Yeah, definitely.
And I mean, I was going to compliment you again, like when you were talking about how you cast her and what you were looking for. I mean, it's obvious you were really thoughtful about this from start to finish, about what you wanted performance-wise, and her ability to help with the misdirect.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, obviously it's a five page dialogue short, right? So it's all performance, right? There's a couple of visual cues, you know, like that's written in with the jacket and stuff like that. But other than that, I mean, it's all going to be sold on performance.
And you guys played with, you know, you did the most you could with two people at a table doing dirty shots, clean shots,
yeah.
You know, profiles.
Yeah, we want, and then for the date, it was Chris's idea. I think we put the camera on sticks and let it get a little more cinematic. You know, for the romantic stuff, let's push in and actually have more of a cinematic look to it. Because you know, for friends, we're gonna shake the camera around for friends, but for the first day of the rest of your life, we're gonna take this seriously and shoot it stable. And so yeah, I mean, I was fortunate in that. I knew what I wanted, which not everybody does, I think, when they set out to make their first project. And I was fortunate in that I knew what I didn't know, which was most things. So I paired myself with somebody who produced a bunch of stuff. I paired myself with a DP who'd shot tons of stuff, who I knew I could turn to and be like, I want this that I don't know how to say. And he'd be like, oh, this. And I'd be like, yes, that's what I want. And, you know, that kind of and even the score. Like, I worked with Sheena, who was the composer on Three's a Crowd. And she's a genius. It was so effortless, but I knew, I mean, I grew up in, like I said, my mother's a musician and music teacher. So I grew up kind of in a house full of music, but don't have that terminology. And I'd never worked with a composer before. So I knew I wanted somebody that was, and she's like the nicest person in the world. So I knew I wanted somebody that I could be like, hey, I want it to make me feel more like, you know, like, and she'd be like, oh yeah, sure. And then she'd be able to do it. Cause I didn't have the verbiage. So I wanted to make sure it was somebody that could communicate with the stupid Patrick who didn't know how to speak their language. And it was,
you're no different effortless. From every other director.
Probably,
know,
yeah.
Not
yeah,
many
yeah.
directors are composers, you know.
But I mean, it's so, oh God, it's so important, right? I mean, yeah. You watch the example is always Star Wars, right? You watch Star Wars with no sound, just music, and you follow the whole story. Even if you'd never seen it before, you can follow the whole story, you know. Richard Donner tells that story about how when he was in scoring with John Williams for the first Superman movie. And he ruined the first take because he screamed, "You're a genius!" when the Superman score starts, because the music basically says Superman, and he's like, "Oh my god!" You know, so it just makes the journey so much fuller. And I mean, if you ever need to pull on a heartstring and you don't have music, you're screwed, right?
It's unlikely. You know,
yeah.
It's unlikely to be. Now you're making me realize I didn't even notice. Is there a change in your music?
Yeah.
I didn't see that's it's so subtle.
Yeah, so
because I think it's your performances are so great that I didn't notice the music change.
Cool. That's that. I think the reason you didn't notice it because it's actually very significant because we actually don't have music, and then as she's primping it for the date, it comes in and it hits. You know, with the big moment, but basically the premise of the whole show, right, is like if she smiles, you're doing well. So on her smile, the music crescendos, right? And I think the reason you probably didn't notice it, I mean, first of all, it's probably been a while since you watched the movie, but
I should watch it right before you came.
Oh, okay, good. Well,
I want to refresh.
I would assume the reason you didn't notice it is because it is so integral to the emotional arc.
Yes.
That it just feels like part of the
exactly.
the story, right?
Which is what's particularly good about it.
That's Sheena. Yeah, she's it's great.
But so the last thing you were telling me about first dates, well, so, and you mentioned you did The Farm for a post and you had a good,
sounds like
you had a good experience the whole way through.
Well, I was very fortunate. If you have a friend who works at YouTube Red who you can produce a film with, who can call in favors, I highly recommend it. I think we had some people work on the movie that wouldn't have looked twice at me knocking on the door and being like, hey, would you work on my movie? You know, is it okay?
Yeah.
So that helped.
And they squoze it in like a night here, a night there, and weekends.
I mean, these guys probably banged it out in 20 minutes. These guys were amazing. Like, we walked into the room and they were like, so, and they, first of all, they had a big scoring stage. So they felt like I was working on Lord of the Rings. It was a great, like, huge area. So it was really cool. But then we're watching the movie and, you know, we had temp tracks in for like crowd noise and stuff like that, and you don't realize how obnoxiously horrible all that stuff is until somebody who's good comes. And I was just like, oh my god, we're in a restaurant.
Yeah,
you know, not only they cleared up all the dialogue and made it all fit seamlessly with what they put in,
and all of a sudden the cinematography looks better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we also had them work on color correction.
Yeah,
and you know, I mean,
so once you finished it, you just hit the festival circuit, or
yeah. I sat down with a friend of mine who's more experienced with this stuff and kind of figured out kind of where we thought it might land festival wise. And I
like, did you have an idea for festivals? I mean,
just small ones like Dan and Sundance.
It sounds like you did it as an exercise.
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from it because a lot of people worked hard on it. So it's not that I thought it's a warm up, but I did think it's a first step. I thought it's not my calling card. It's my first you know, attempt. You know what I mean? Which, of course, is my calling card till I have enough.
Yeah, sure. Card. Definitely.
But, yeah, so I kind of... We budgeted... In the original budget, we budgeted for some festival stuff, and I didn't...
Which puts you ahead of, like, 97%. Well,
everybody I knew told me to do that. Everybody I knew told me to do that. And then, you know, I basically used that up and was like, okay, anything left over or anything else I want to have is probably going to funnel to the next one. But, yeah, I mean, there was the New Filmmakers in New York and in L.A. I had yours, and I had the Culver City Film Festival. And nice little run. And then I got Palm Springs. Sent me a very nice, hey, we're not going to screen your film, but we're going to put you on our channel so people that go to the film festival can watch it kind of thing. And I was like, oh, that's nice. So, yeah. You know, and I spoke with a filmmaker who I very much respect, who's much further down this road than me. And he was like, listen, man, this film's beautiful and it's great, but it's simple. And it's not the kind of thing that's going to, like, festival, a lot of, like, the bigger festivals like stuff that's a little edgy or that's going to take us a different direction. But I kind of knew that. I knew, like, yeah, I mean, this is not a head turner.
Tribeca's and your Sundance's, they want...
Yeah, this was not my head...
A topic or something.
Yeah, this is not... Yeah, we don't...
Yeah, it's a happy film.
Yeah, it's not about veterans getting abortions. I mean, you know, it's a simple...
I think I told you at the Q&A, I think I throw this out... Our good friend Chris Kramer points out that I bring up the girlfriend too much in Q&As, but you know, because I show you know, if I like a film, you know, and the jury's voting for it, then you know I show her all the ones I like.
Yeah,
and she does not like rom-coms, and she doesn't, you know, almost all love stories. She's like, oh, come on, that's bullcrap.
Yeah,
and yours, she was like, oh, like, you know,
oh, good, yeah,
like. You know, that is a harder accomplishment, mm-hmm. I think, doing a satisfying, not date movie, but a satisfying emotional connection film.
Yeah.
I bet most of the festivals that are looking for the soldier coming back from war contemplating suicide over a bottle of Jack Daniels movies.
Yeah.
I think they're not realizing how simple that extreme moment is and how challenging the moments you grab are.
Thank you. Nothing's simple if you want to tell a story.
No,
well,
but I mean,
but I do think,
no, you make people feel something though.
That's good, man. Thank you. Know? Yeah. I really think if you go performance first, if you're after performance, like you're going to do that because, you know, and you know, the score helps and all the other stuff helps. But yeah, I think, in general, if you're not feeling something, it's probably either the script was just not workable, or the acting wasn't there. You know, because we've all seen movies where the sound's terrible and it takes you out of it. But then 5 minutes in or 3 minutes in, you're like, but they're good and it's a good story and I can watch this and remember at the end like, oh yeah, the sound was bad. But you know, if the story is compelling and the actors are good, like it can suck you in.
Cool. So what are you planning? So you already said you're planning to do the other short. That's
yeah,
more
so,
challenging.
So I'm going to, it's kind of a trilogy of sorts, I think, where, this one is about a connection, right? The next one's going to be about kind of a lack of connection, a missed connection. And then the third one's kind of about a negative connection, a connection where someone is manipulating another person. But again, not knowing this until I wrote a bunch, like it's all some version of the truth, right? Manipulating the truth, you know, not telling everybody everything. But so the next one is basically about how hard it is to, thank God. I mean, I just got engaged, as you know, and thank God, because dating is so hard right now, I think, in this day and age with the everything. So it's kind of about how hard it is to have an honest to God connection with a human being. Kind of the opposite thematically of the movie I just made.
So trilogy. You got, yes, a trilogy in mind.
Yes.
Because you're into Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I'm a nerd. And it's not a continuation of any kind of storyline or anything. It's just thematically, right? So it's a connection, a missed connection, and a bad connection. A connection that's going to result in harm for somebody.
I love a trilogy. I don't know why. I think we've all been trained to think in trilogies. So I'm actually really looking forward to Patrick completing that trilogy because I really liked part one. And the other parts he told me about sound pretty good. In fact, he kind of explained the entirety of the next one to me and... You know, the podcast was already almost an hour, so I cut it off. You know, you're just going to have to wait till he makes it. In the meantime, go to discoveryindiefilm.com. There's a lot of great short films you can watch that are embedded right into that website. You can get links to the Film Invasion Los Angeles site, which is a festival program that's going to be June 7th, 8th, and 9th in 2019, which happens to be this year. And you can also get a link to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that's coming up in November. And if social media is your thing, check us out at DIFWINS on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. The handle for Discover Indie Film is at DIFWINS. My thanks again to Patrick for coming in and doing the interview. And thank you for listening.